Hey, Fiends of the Pod, this is your host, film critic and comedian Nate Wyckoff, reminding you to like, subscribe, and comment. You can also go to cultandclassicfilms.com/subscribe and sign up to have cult exclusive movies sent to your door every single month. These are ultra low budget exclusive films that we get to you in the best quality possible with tons of extras like commentaries, milk caps, autographed posters, slip covers, all sorts of neat things. And remember, every time you like, subscribe, and buy a movie from us, you prevent Michael Bay from making one more film. So go ahead, subscribe, and enjoy.
Welcome to Cult and Classic.
Welcome, friends and fiends of the pod, to a brand new episode of Cult and Classic Films Podcast, the podcast where we bring you two thematically linked films, one mainstream and one cult, and talk about them both. I am here with longtime contributor Mandy Longley. How are you doing, Mandy?
I'm ready at the gates of this to go. Ready.
Yes, excellent. And I, of course, am your host, film critic and comedian Nate Wyckoff. We are just the two of us today, as many of our listeners, I'm sure, are experiencing. There is a winter storm slamming much of the country and probably several outside of the country that I am completely unaware of, because in the U.S., we don't hear about things outside of the U.S. And let's see, Tad Mastriani, Jeffrey Tucker, they are both without power and have been without power for a day since, 4 a.m.
Even worse, without internet.
Without internet. I don't know what you would do. I can't even imagine. So luckily I don't have to, because in Palm Springs, there is no snow right now, or pretty much ever. Okay. So I've been looking forward to this. Last week we talked about part one of this two-parter that we call Look Out Below. And it was Tremors from 1990 with Kevin Bacon, Michael Gross, and tons of wonderful, wonderful people, including Reba McEntire. Tremors is a beloved cable staple. It ran on USA and TNT pretty much every hour on the hour for about 15 years. And it is a delight. There, I believe there are 7 sequels and a TV series. And unfortunately, there was a revival TV series that was pitched that was to include Kevin Bacon, but it was turned down most likely because of the cost. But it would have been fun. Anywho-zits, this week we have its more cult counterpart, and that is Gate 2, The Trespassers from 1990. It was actually finished, I think, in 1989, but it didn't get released for quite a while. It says it was released in 1990. I actually think, looking at the releases, it probably was released in 91, somewhere around there, but it was released in the UK first, so the US did not see it until later than that even. The reason being is that New Century, who released the first Gate film, which is kind of a cult classic for sure, is they closed their doors and then they sold it, and then Gate 2 is then released elsewhere. The interesting thing is, of course, we could have chosen The Gate, which is the story of two kids, one a troubled kid whose, I believe, mother has passed and loves heavy metal. And together, the kids play a metal record backwards, which opens a gate to hell in their backyard. There is then a demon that arrives after their little tiny, spooky humanoid minions, these stop-motion animated and costume combo creatures, run amok. It's a delightful film. It's definitely one of the films that inspired Stranger Things and other sort of 80s kid horror throwbacks. But the reason we chose Gate 2 is because Gate 2 is much harder to see. It is much more obscure at this point in time because it has not been re-released, I believe, since VHS. So it is obnoxiously difficult. And I don't even think it's streaming on Amazon. I could not find any information on why. I can only assume that there are licensing issues involved with this movie in some part. But the film it is a direct continuation of The Gate. The characters are a bit older. The original lead character is no longer there. His house is abandoned and blocked off with chains and warning signs. But his friend, who is the Lewis Tripp, who was in, of course, The Gate and The Gate 2, and also 1986 film The Campbells, very recognizable actor. You've seen him in probably bit parts, if nothing else. He is still around, and his dad has become an alcoholic who has lost his flying job for Pan Am. And the character, Lewis Tripp's character, whose name is Terrence, has decided to summon the demons again, because they will basically grant him the wish to give his father his life back. You learn that, spoiler alert, he walked in on his father almost committing suicide once, and so he's terrified of that. So his whole goal is to help his father get back on his feet. However, during the ritual, which potentially would go well, some local hooligans, a la, what is it, Ice and Scum or whatever, that's not it, but the guys from... the characters from Hocus Pocus, very similar, yes. A little less bumbling. They break in, of course, the tough guy, the 50s greaser in 1990, for some reason, and his girlfriend and the Mutton Jeff, you know, guy Mo, who just laughs and is like, you know, the equivalent of, what are we going to do today? What are we going to do today? Blah, 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 just that kind of go. They break in. They crash the party of trying to raise the demons for a some sort of transaction, and they actually don't screw it up, which is kind of interesting. I kind of liked that two of the characters, the goofy follower and the girlfriend, actually are interested in the events, and so they begrudgingly convince the tough guy to be a part of it as well. Well, the tough guy ends up seeing a minion and shoots it, which kind of screws up the whole thing. And the minion, dead, is taken by Terrence to his house, where it's thrown in a jar of water. I don't know where he got a jar this big. It's a big jar. It's like a...
We just really like pickles. So,
yeah, it must be. Or like pickled eggs or something. Pickles. It's huge.
Yeah.
So it is... but he keeps it in there, sort of like one of those, you know, pickled fetuses or fake aliens. Mm-hmm. I assume they're fake. I mean, I can't prove it. But yeah, so that's where he is. Of course, it heals itself. It breaks free. It recaptures it, and they can basically burn an item and make a wish, and that wish will be granted. Terry's continues to happen as his dad first gets a job as a baggage handler. That's not enough. So then he gets a job again as an intercontinental pilot. And the problem they find out is that these wishes are not done properly. So they have a short lifespan and literally turn to shit afterwards. So any objects turn into shit. It's pretty great.
I think that was the biggest laugh I had during the whole movie. It was
great.
Like, yeah.
And they did the special effects. The Gate One is famous for its special effects, its design, especially of the minions, and then the stop motion animation and the combination of that along with the what would you call it? The little the suit, you know, it's sort of like it's the reverse kaiju. Instead of a person in a suit that's made to look giant, there are people in suits that are made to look very, very tiny. And, you know, think the tiny ashes from Army of Darkness kind of thing. They're really, really great. They have personalities. The little minion, we only have one this time around, but he's constantly sort of messing with stuff, rubbing his head when he gets poked, just being a little character all of himself. I wish we got more of him, but this movie still has a ton of practical effects. It is just complete wall-to-wall practical effects. We have the shit, which is occasionally once or twice flung, but mostly we just see the items, like they wish for a car, they wish for a camcorder, all these things. We see them sort of half transmogrified into piles of shit. And it's really cool, especially the car. That was a big pile of fake shit with like a headlight melting out. Mm-hmm. It was really cool. Really good job. It's great. We also have, again, spoiler alert, if you think there's a chance you want to see this movie and you don't want anything spoiled, I don't think there are any twists in this movie, really. I'm not going to say that I knew what was going to happen, but it's not a twist movie, right? There's no big reveal. So it's not going to ruin it for you, I would say. The characters, the three men in that group of people who are at the, I'm not going to say a seance, but a conjuring of sorts, they begin to turn into minions, much larger, but they turn into minions. And it turns out they are the three vices or three powers that are needed to open the gates to hell and destroy the earth. And the woman, the girl who's there, is the sacrifice. So it comes to a head in the other side, which again, clearly this is kind of an inspiration for Stranger Things with the under upside down, excuse me. So anyway, lots of greatness in this. Of course, things sort of work out in the end, much like the first Gate film, spoiler alert again, things turn out good and everyone survives, including the animal. But you have to wait till after the credits because this movie has a post-credit scene, 1989 produced film with a post-credit scene. I knew it was coming because I knew that it was a point in the first movie. And I'm like, they're not going to let that hamster stay dead. Of course, the hamster is sort of crucial in the beginning of the film. Terry takes it out, kisses it, clearly has affection for it, but you know he's going to sacrifice it to make the trade. But turns out he can't bring himself to do it. So big, jerky, tough guy is like, oh, do it. They have a lot of great narrative parallels in this. The tough guy forces Terrence to forces his hand to kill the hamster. And then he tries to do the same when he's a big monster to force Terrence to kill his new girlfriend, of course, because that is kind of a trope that is pretty obvious from the get-go, is the girl is going to fall for this guy instead of the hot guy. And it's good for
stereotypical good looks or demon summoning.
I mean, that is a power move. Probably, yeah. That's kind of the tough guy is played by James Villamere. I believe that's how you pronounce his name, but he was in Matinee 1993 with John Goodman, Private Parts from 97 with Howard Stern. And we get the tough guy's lackey, Mo, which is such a great lackey name. Current horror fans will definitely recognize him. He was in Saw 4. He was in the 2006 production of The Sentinel and the thriller Traitor with Michael Cheadle, I believe it was, from 2008. Don Cheadle. I said Michael Cheadle. I was thinking of Michael J. White, but it's definitely Don Cheadle. They are not the same person. Terrence Howard is not the same person either, but I know if you are a listener of the pod that I said Michael J. White first played Randy Rhodes in Iron Man and then was replaced at Robert Downey Jr.'s behest with Don Cheadle, but it was not. It was Terrence Howard who was replaced, and I apologize. They're both fantastic actors, and I do not mean to remember that incorrectly. That's neither here nor there. We've got some stuff to talk about. I thoroughly enjoyed this movie. This movie is actually... I will say this. The first film has more suit effects on the little creatures because there's a ton of them and a smidgen more stop motion effects to kind of pan it out. But this one, that movie is very predictable. You know kind of what's going to happen. It's sort of like it's Poltergeist combined with Don't Be Afraid of the Dark, the original TV movie, sort of that kind of thing. So you know what's going to happen. Still great. Monster House by Rob Schrab and Dan Harmon of Rick and Morty fame and many other things. They made or wrote the movie Monster House, the 3D animated film, which is a delight with Steve Buscemi. And that's also a similar kind of vibe. You sort of got the equivalent of a haunted house, but it's a conjured haunted house like Poltergeist or something along those lines. It's predictable. It's a delight, but it's predictable. The Gate 2, I didn't really know what was going to happen for most of the movie. I'm not going to say it was a shock, but I'm like, where is this going? And it was a satisfying not knowing.
Agree. Like you could definitely pick up like the normal beats and like kind of tell when they were transitioning from like exposition to like more of the plot, but you didn't really know what they were going to do with that plot or where exactly like you kind of could tell that they were going to turn into the three creatures or like the three main demons, but like not exactly like how or what that would look like. Like you didn't I thought that was so a little surprising. It was good.
We get
it
was a gross good, but
it wasn't.
Where...
It wasn't like yeah.
Yeah,
just gonna say it wasn't like pre-written. Like they didn't follow like a really standard script.
Yeah, I mean, I think I agree with that. And I think that's its biggest strength among the effects and sort of just the general vibe. The soundtrack is, I thought, quite excellent, too. It is very exactly what you want from a spooky lightning in the sky happens at night horror movie, you know, just very ominous, very sort of Tales from the Crypt, just a classic pulpy horror soundtrack with some tension stings and minor keys. Just, it was good. And I really didn't think that from the first opening scene, it really did set the whole mood. We also have some from narration from Terrence in the beginning that really does a good job of explaining the backstory of the first film without doing what, say, the Friday the 13th series did, which is replay essentially an abridged version of the film before it for 15 minutes. That, you know, it doesn't do that. And while back in the day when you couldn't get the VHS of a movie readily, that was not so bad because you got to see it again and you hadn't probably seen it since it was in theaters before. Now, of course, we get very tired of that sort of thing because we do see, we could just watch the previous movie before going to the theater and watching the next one, such as Dune, which we'll talk about, I'm sure, at another time, Dune 2. So,
yes, please.
Absolutely. We're the Dune fans here. So if you're interested in our takes on the first film and the other franchise entries, go listen to our Dune recap episode from quite a ways back. Maybe we'll replay that for you at some point soon. So, good effects. The characters are pretty good, even though they're standard characters. They serve the purpose well, I think. Terrence is, he's actually more of the sort of calm guy in this one, because in the first one, he is more of the troublemaker. You know, he's like, my parent just died, and I believe, and sort of like, yeah, I'm gonna play this record backward. What's the difference? Like, it's not gonna happen. Nothing's gonna happen. You know, he's the good kid that became kind of a rebel because his life fell apart. And in this one, he's kind of moved beyond to what you would expect of a Milhouse, like a more self-driven Milhouse from Simpsons. In fact, he made me think of the Simpsons episode, if Simpsons fans are listening, which I'm sure you are, where Milhouse's parents get a divorce. And so he becomes like this disgruntled, like, yeah, I don't care. And it makes him super cool. He's sort of that in the first movie. And now he's back to being a little bit of a Milhouse. But, you know, he can take care of himself, but he's a little bit of the meh, that kind of guy. They also have some interesting characterizations in this movie, which sort of sets it apart from some of the other monster versus children entries in the 80s and early 90s. And I think that's another reason why I imagine this film is kind of a, intentional or not, and probably intentional, a big inspiration of Stranger Things. We get the characters, we get more of the character than you need for the plot to move ahead. For example, Mo, we get that he has a job and he wants to keep the job and he wants to do well, but his rude dude friend is more kind of coerces him to doing things. He is definitely one of those characters who is a follower, but he does have sort of a desire to not do wrong. He would kind of go ahead if he gives the vibe that if his friend was a good guy, then Mo would also be a good guy, but it doesn't matter because he's not, right? So we get a scene with him. He doesn't want to smoke weed because he's working at his job and his friend convinces him to. And it's just there for character development, right? Because there's no other reason. We learned that the wish of the tough kid was to be king of the world, which, right, it just screams, okay, we understand, as if we didn't already, that this character is incredibly insecure, which drives his super hyper masculine, you know, aggressive stance. Whereas the love interests story played by Pamela Alden, who has been in many things, she actually is extremely well known for voice acting, and I love her work in animation. She is Bobby from King of the Hill. She is also Layla in Vampire Hunter D: Bloodlust, the American edition. So she's done some really great work as well as great acting. People, maybe depending on how big you are in TV movies, you might have recognized her as the character Dolores in Grease 2. So she's got quite a bit of great, unique roles to her name. She is also kind of a great character because while we don't know much of her life, we get the vibe that maybe she loves her mom, she wants to take care of her mom. She's, you know, it's another single parent home. We don't really get much except that she seems to be kind of nice, but she also is clearly with a tough guy who's attractive because he's attractive and isn't in love with him. Right. That's interesting. He's clearly in love with her and very, you know, he's given her like essentially a promise ring but she's very clear.
In a leather jacket.
Which, by the way, we keep getting leather jackets. There are several different leather jackets that pop on Terrence and Pamela's, I forget, what is her name in this movie?
I don't remember.
Pamela Alden. That kind of is, I guess, indicative. The names are not necessarily that important, but she does a good job of being sort of a driving force occasionally in the movie and also not a victim, even though she is the like damsel in distress who's caught and is going to be the sacrifice. She is given her due, and I don't think she's treated as a prop.
She's more like a partner in a lot of it.
Yeah, I agree. I do think she certainly could. She could have been the lead character, frankly. And that would have been interesting to approach it from that way, where one of your main characters that returns from the first movie is not the main character in the second, but is there through the whole movie. But it also kind of wouldn't make as much sense because his being the one that opened the portal in the first one and this one, I think, checks out.
Hmm.
So we get some classic spooky moments in this movie. I think we get probably most classic is the mad crazy dad crashing the plane intentionally that happens in a dream that Terrence has. He's his dad who's an alcoholic, and the whole movie you're thinking like, should he be flying a plane? Like, I know you want him to have his life back, but he clearly is an alcoholic and drinks all the time, right?
So I thought that he just like wished for him to have a job again, which was the baggage handling job. And then like their wishes got out of control and kept getting bigger.
Yes.
And then that was why he got the flight. Like, and I wasn't sure if it was a dream or not when he was flying the plane super drunk.
It must have been, he must have been drunk. But it couldn't have been.
Yeah, like, don't they have to go to the hospital?
And yeah, he's in the hospital and he's in like a coma or something. He's all bandaged up. But it had to be a dream on some level because it was they said it was not a passenger plane. It was a. So obviously it's some sort of premonition or psychic link because his dad most likely was drunk. They don't say. I don't think they say it explicitly. They might. The guy from the from Pan Am. Which sure that they loved this little plug, you know, like, you know, trying to screw the kid out of any liability claims for his dad and also hiring a drunk guy to fly their planes. I'm sure that, you know, but Pan Am had a perfect track record anyway. So we've got some pretty interesting characters, nothing new, I'd say, but they play their parts well. And then, like I said, I think my favorite character is the minion because he does have these good moments. You actually feel sorry for him sometimes. He's just like in the first movie, they're little wussy creatures. Like they are the epitome of a minion. Yeah. They do the bidding of their master, but you know, they say the name of the big old demons and they cower. They are terrified and pressed against the wall, like a mouse trying to escape, you know, a cat when they're fleeing. And then they also attack to try and escape, but they're also bumbling. I mean, at one point, the big, you know, the big Lord of the Rings, you know, throw the ring into the volcano moment is when the three boys have turned into these three demon creatures that have to sacrifice someone. And the woman is escaped, tried to throw this box with the minion and some of their cherished possessions into the gate as the book they have, I believe from the first movie. I don't remember that.
I was like, where did they get this book? Did he just like go to the library?
Yeah. Did he get this ancient like this, tome?
Like know? This expert in like these demon summoning rituals. And I'm like, what kind of materials do they have in their local library?
I know. And that's why I'm like, I can't remember if the book.
To a lot of flea markets. Like, I don't understand where he got this book.
I trust me. I have not found one there yet. I I did watch The Gate a while back. We've put this episode off so many times. I apologize, everyone out there, but I hope you've been enjoying the episodes that we've revisited for you. We have quite a few in our stable. We're going over 2 years now. But I don't remember a book from the first one. I could be wrong. There are liner notes from the album that they play backwards to open the gate to hell in the first one. Perhaps it extended beyond that. I don't remember. So that could be my fault. But yes, he has a book from the beginning. It's the equivalent of the Necronomicon, and it helps him do the ritual. He also has it's a little bit evil speak. It's a little bit Golgotha Falls, the novel, which by the way is pretty great. If you check that out, if you can find a copy, is one of the 80s, early 90s horror paperbacks, which used to be everywhere and now are quite difficult to find. Paperbacks from hell, kind of thing. They have this sort of like technology used to track, supernatural stuff, much like Prince of Darkness from John Carpenter, that sort of thing, which we also talked about on this pod in the past. They have lots of little things like that. It's sort of like if you took a huge number of successful 80s horror films and just cherry-picked the pieces that you really like. There is sort of a divide between maybe the first half and the second half of the movie, or the first two thirds and the final two third, where it becomes less the wish thing is totally gone, and we are now in the phase of everybody is turning into a monster except for the girl, and they have to throw the minion into the pit to hell before the sacrifice is carried out. I think the second half is maybe a little slower. It could have been faster, but at the same time, the movie clocks in, I think, at like 93 minutes, so about an hour and a half. I believe I was not bored, I would say, but there is definitely a pacing change, and I don't know what you might have done to alter that. You could have had the transformation with the bad with the rough and tumble guy who is the only one to completely go through the transformation. You could have had it happen maybe a little earlier, but then it would change the sequence of events, because the nature of what actually happened. I do think you could do it though. I think you could do it. It wasn't a big break for me though. I don't know if you noticed that and how you felt about the length of the film in
I feel
general.
like I was like, I think around the time that the two bad kids were in the
Bad kids.
restaurant,
Yeah,
I
me
said
too.
bad kids. I thought that I was like, this is, they're spending a very long time on
Yeah.
this like restaurant
Which is a
scene.
very
Like,
weird moment. For those of you who've seen Venom, the Tom Hardy film about the Spider-Man villain that Sony put out without Spider-Man, I enjoyed it, but it's not a perfect film. But he has this scene where he's really hungry. It's when he's first attached to the symbiote creature that makes him into Venom. And they've got a dual relationship, a two-party relationship going on. And he like shoves his head, he like falls into the lobster tank and starts eating lobsters, and he looks a mess. It was weird because it was that sort of like, this is a snooty restaurant, sir. Like, you're dressed like you're walking on the street. You're dressed like a normal person. You shouldn't be here. And then he like loses his shit. It's sort of that moment. Which again has been done elsewhere, but that is very much what it's
It
reminiscent
was just
of.
that it just went on for such a long time.
The
And
transition
for
to it is very odd too.
and then there's like, the like a scene that people who have listened to the pod for a long time would assume that I would like, because there he was in a bathroom and they were assuming he
Yeah.
was in some kind of gastric distress. The like poop jokes and stuff. I should have been all super like thrilled and entertained by that, because I have the sense of humor of a 3-year-old. But like, it wasn't, it just was so much.
Yeah.
Like, and you'd
And
already
there
kind
wasn't
of
any actual
like,
poop. Like, they could have had him actually like poop, right? Like, I mean, not
guess
to be gross, but he's in the stall and he's leaking like pus. Like, he's got a
everything.
huge
Like,
pimple or something. Like, and
and
he's
it's just
becoming this
falling
monster.
apart.
I agree. I actually think you could have worked it where he ate something that he wished for, and then he's literally defecating defecation, which is vile. But it would have actually made sense, because we don't really understand the transition there. I
but
think,
anyway, it was almost boring by that point because yes. I think it at that point in the movie is when the pacing really changed, and they wanted to they did a lot more long, like it almost feels like in some other independent films we watched where they like just film someone walking for too long.
Yep.
And where it becomes like the editing process becomes so important that you don't realize that from more mainstream films where where that pacing and like even holding it like maybe 1 second longer than what is really necessary to get the point across of what is happening, like you lose it, not necessarily lose the interest, but the pacing feels off. It feels too long of a beat. Yep. And then this scene, the same thing happened. They had stuff to say and stuff was going on. It wasn't that we were like watching someone.
It wasn't a car parking for 15 minutes.
But, yeah, maybe, right? So it wasn't like that, but it also, compared to the rest of the film and how the story overall fit together, it didn't really match the rest of the film. And you can definitely feel it at this point. And like, by the time this character finally, like you finally hit like the real good stuff of like characters transitioning into demons, you're not as engaged or excited about it happening. You were just more waiting for them to make their point or like wrap up like the previous.
It killed the tension, any tension that there was. Like you're now you're absolutely waiting. And also I agree. And because it's almost right on that 90-minute cusp, I am sure what happened is they were short and the distributor said, you have to pad this out. A feature has to be has to be 90 minutes, which of course is kind of sad since the company ended up folding and the movie didn't get a theatrical release, right? Because then you get like, you know, oh, we didn't have to do that. We could have made this 1:15 and it would have been a much tighter thing. Because I agree, the restaurant is the biggest one, especially since we cut several times back and forth to Mo waiting at the table when the other guy is left to go to the bathroom and it's going through this horrible transformation. And they keep cutting back and forth. And you could have had it literally just, he realizes something is wrong. He goes to the bathroom. Then the maitre d' comes in, uses the urinal, washes his hands, and hears the horrible sounds from the stall, which, by the way, I did have like a eye rolling funny moment with that, because at one point he's like screaming and the snooty maitre d' looks down and his foot is like kicking under the stall and is smearing blood everywhere. And he's like, "Sir, are you in distress?" Just like, nope, totally fine. Sitting on the floor in a bathroom stall, kicking in my own blood. It's perfect.
Yeah. Good. Yeah.
There's some insane lines in this movie. There's some of the, it's that got that like that really specific 90s make up terms that nobody would ever use thing. Like Pamela's character saying of her boyfriend, "He can be a real toad." Like, what? Who? Nobody says that. Nobody's ever said that. There was one, I can't remember. Mo says it when they first are experiencing the conjuring of the demon, and it's something like I'm not getting it right at all, but it's this kind of insane juxtaposition where it's like, "Holy horse stall, you know, Jesus Christ." And you're just like, wait, what? Like the first half is gibberish that's like pretend cursing, and the second half is like just a classic curse. And it's all one statement. And it does have one of the best 80s horror movie lines, legitimately best I have ever heard in my whole life. And it is in the beginning. It's when the three bad kids come in and disrupt Terrence's ceremony, and he's like, "So like, what are you, a Satanist or something?" And he looks at me, he goes, "Satan." He's like demonology. And he's like, "Oh, like, was it Satan?" He's like, "Demonology, Satanism is for pussies." It's just like, what an insane line. Like, it's so true to life, because it's the most insane gatekeepery thing. You know, like, you know, Terrence would be like a huge like otaku anime nerd if it was like 20 years later. He would be that kid and they'd be like, "Oh, you like Dragon Ball?" And he's like, "It's Naruto." Okay, like, they're totally different. Like, that would be like the sort of vibe that he gives at that moment. And I adored, you know, we in the film and cult realm, we all know, possibly haven't even been at some point, that ridiculous gatekeeper-y. You know, I think for me, it was the whole like Star Wars, Star Trek. Like, I love them both, but people be like, "Oh, you like Star Wars?" I'm like, "It's a Star Trek book," you know, something like that. And he's like, "Okay, calm down. It's people in space shooting things and talking to aliens. So, it's all the same shit. Just taco or burrito. You know, that's reductive and not the case. They're very different foods, but it's the vibe that it gives." So, I think we're about ready to wrap up. I just want to talk about one more thing. Anyone who's seen the VHS cover, which is also, I guess, in theory, the poster for Gate 2, although I haven't actually seen a print poster of this. As I said, it did not have a theatrical release, at least in the United States. Perhaps it did overseas. You guys can write in and correct me if that's not the case, but as far as I can tell, that is the case. It is in no way indicative of the movie. There is what looks to be some sort of demon hand, like a minion hand, reaching up like an old piece of wood or maybe a rock cliff face. It's the hole, I assume, from the first movie. And beyond it, you see this like dark blue, thundering nighttime sky with these two evil monster eyes staring towards you. And there are no giant evil eyes in the sky. I don't even think there's any thunder or lightning or any storm of any kind. And I guess if you look close, maybe the eyes are supposed to be representative of the, you know, the greaser's transformed, you know, face, but you're really stretching there. It's one of those cases where I'm like, nobody, whoever did this poster, which is quite pretty, they hadn't seen the movie. They hadn't seen the movie. They saw the first one maybe, and they were like, "Hey, can you do this?" And it's like, "Yeah, what's it about?" Like, I don't know, same shit. And so they just did this random poster. It's also oddly lopsided for the film. The composition is a little unusual, which I don't mind. It actually makes it more interesting. It's a long way to go talking about the poster for the film, but I do think it's interesting when the poster is really completely irrelevant to the film in many ways. So thank you all so much. Mandy, would you recommend the Gate 2, Gate 2, The Trespassers? By the way, there is no indication that this film is actually called The Trespassers, except on the IMDb, and I assume in early marketing materials, because the film itself is just called Gate 2 on both the box, the poster, and the credits.
I would recommend it. It was super fun. And like you said, all the practical effects that they did and the suits that they had and everything was really great. I honestly wish that we saw more of that outside of truly independent films that are done that way for budgetary purposes, because they're beautiful and they, I think, ignite the imagination and they give it such a tactile presence of like realism. And I miss it. And so whenever we revisit one of these older films, like from the 80s and 90s, like it is always a delight.
I agree.
Plus, it's like, yeah.
And I want to
Plus, yeah,
say
I
that.
was going to say, like, the plot stuff that we talked about, just not being super predictable and fun. And, like, you know, they're not just like cookie cutter characters for the female, like, co-lead. It was a nice little film. Thank you, Nate.
She's also, just to throw it in there, she's also not played for sex. Like, yes, she's the romance, and yes, there's a kiss or two between her and Terrence, and also her and her boyfriend. But there's, you know, she's the most revealing thing she wears is sort of like a short top when she's gonna be sacrificed. It's not ridiculous. You know, nobody would be sent home in eighth grade for wearing it. Usually they all have jackets on. Like I said, there's a couple of different leather jackets for no clear reason. I don't know why he dreamed of a different leather jacket, but that is unusual. I also want to mention Michael Nankin wrote this film. He directed quite a few episodes actually in the 2005 to 2009 Battlestar Galactica reboot series, as well as some other mini series and fairly well received mini series, particularly Westerns, most recently 20 and 22. And then the director also, Tibor Takacs, like probably butchering his name. He directed a movie. He directed and released a movie as recently as 2022. I think his best known film is probably 96's Sabrina the Teenage Witch with Melissa Joan Hart that launched, of course, the even more successful TV series. But he also did the 80s horror film I, Madman, which was released in 89, the year before, or 2 years before, depending on where you live, The Gate 2 was released. So thank you all so much. I also recommend this movie. Watch it, especially watch for the couple of scenes where the Minion characters fly at the screen, like when it's shot in the first scene. It's a great, fast green screen effect. It's just, they use the technology excellently. And I believe Michael Cook is the special effects artist. I apologize if I'm incorrect on that. But he and his, I assume, team does an absolutely fantastic job and should be commended on every level. So thank you all. Next week, we will have another episode for you. We will be smattering some rebroadcasts in here to sort of bring you some long ago episodes that deserve a little re-listen as we gear up for some brand new cool things for you. As always, check out cultandclassicfilms.com to see what exclusive collector's edition Blu-ray features we have for sale for you. There are some amazing ones, including the North Korean film Pulgasari, which is a great companion piece to the new Godzilla King Kong films, because who doesn't love giant monsters, especially one like Pulgasari, that donates directly to the Liberty in North Korea initiative. And we have some others. And you can go to patreon.com/cultandclassicfilms and get our new release movies every single month delivered to your door for super cheap. $20 for the standard one, shipping included, and $25 for the collector's edition, which has a signed poster, a 5-piece milk cap set, remember those, and a reversible slip cover. All sorts of cool, cool things. Have a great one. Enjoy, and we will catch you on the next episode of Cult and Classic Films Podcast. Hey everyone, thanks for listening to Cult and Classic Podcast. This podcast is important to me, but what's more important are the rights, privileges, and freedom from violence of everyone in this country and in this world. And that means supporting Black Lives Matter. If you'd like to make a donation, please go ahead and visit cultandclassicpodcast.com, where we have a list of places you can donate and help out. And please stay safe.